Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Here are some interesting articles from the January 2021 issue of True West Magazine. Sweetheart of Lonesome Dove. In an exclusive interview, Diane Lane talks about her latest Western, Leading Men, Directors, and Hope for the Next Chance to Ride on Screen. Let Him Go may be the most remarkable female-driven Western since Joan Crawford and Mercedes McCambridge came to blows in 1954's Johnny Guitar. But even its star is a little tentative on the genre. What is the criteria for a Western? Diane Lane asks. Is there a horse in it? Is it the zip code? Is it the time frame? This film, I think, qualifies. We have several boxes checked. Lane plays Margaret Blackledge, who is married to retired lawman and husband Kevin Costner, and is thrilled and a little overbearing to be a grandparent. The couple's son is killed in a farm accident, and after their daughter-in-law remarries, the Blackledges have little contact with their grandson. Then, no contact when overnight the three move away to live in the boondocks with the husband's criminal family, dominated by nightmarish matriarch Blanche Weeboy. The Blackledges must fight tooth and nail on the ground, not the courts, to save the boy. I hoped writer-director Thomas Bazuka would picture me in this character because she was a grandmother, and I understood this internal struggle of trying to get through something emotionally that you're not ready to do. The fact that that issue is the propellant for the plot is pretty unusual. With a laugh, she added, "Also, any excuse to get a horse is good for me. It's wonderful. The only time I really got to ride was in Cattle Annie and Little Britches when I was a kid, and once again in The Virginian with Bill Pullman for TNT. I think of horses as more than animals, probably because they interact with us so much. There's a special sensibility and sensitivity. I suppose they have to because they're defenseless. All they can do is run." She had another great older leading man on Universal's Cattle Annie. To work with Burt Lancaster was just epic. Sometimes director Lamont Johnson and Burt would really get into it. There was one time everybody had to go to their trailers. We had to call a 15-minute cool-off period between the star and the director. We were down in Durango, Mexico on John Wayne's ranch, which is vast, like a county. It was Amanda Plummer's first film. What a debut. She was just the personification of a pistol. We had so many wonderful actors, John Savage, Scott Glenn. 8 years later, Lane played her defining role in the Western genre as Lorena Wood to Robert Duvall's Gus McCrae in the miniseries Lonesome Dove, while widely considered the best made-for-television Western of all time. Some say the best Western, period. That's right, Lori Darlin. Something magical happened there between the page and the screenplay and the performance and the audience that was emboldening. It's a strike. Larry McMurtry won the Pulitzer Prize, rightfully so. It was brave writing. Tough writing. The fact that teleplay writer Bill Whitliff didn't win the Emmy for bringing it to the screen blew my mind. Tommy Lee Jones delivers his most dour performance, and Duvall his most delightful. Robert was in character the whole time, but I didn't know it. When it came time to promote the piece, I hadn't seen him for quite some time, and looked at him and I thought, "Who is that? And what have you done with Gus?" Because he was the actor, not the character. I had so much fun with Gus, but that lives forever on film. In her next miniseries, The Oldest Living Confederate Widow Tells All, Lane played the child bride of 50-year-old Donald Sutherland, who was a soldier at 13 in the Civil War. Lane plays her for the first half century, and Anne Bancroft plays her preparing to turn 100. Getting to work with Donald Sutherland was amazing, and Bancroft was fascinating. The only sad part was that we never had any scenes together. I had just had my daughter, like 3 weeks before I was in front of the camera. I was trying to breastfeed and be in a corset. I thought the challenge was so exciting, and I'm glad I did it, but it was kind of a blur. In 1995's Wild Bill, Walter Hill cast Lane in the brief but central role of the woman who ruins the life of Jeff Bridges' Hickok. She's only seen in dreams. Walter was experimenting with different film stocks and lenses, trying to give the sense of what is a flashback, a premonition, an opium-addled memory. I don't always mention it because I don't think people know I'm in it. Having completed Let Him Go, would Lane be interested in doing another Western? Oh, I would love to. I just want to find material that allows me to be who I am and where I am in my life right now. They say we actresses have one season. We get spring. That's not so true anymore, but it's always good to keep reminding people that there's a lot more to mine out of somebody besides what God gave them when they were 25, you know? Here's an article from True West magazine entitled Assassination Nation. In this issue, we take on the bloody conflagration known as the Mexican Revolution from 1910 to 1920. It's actually half revolution and half civil war, and a bloodbath at both ends. The statistics are off the charts, with an estimated 1.5 million deaths from fighting, more than all the U.S. death totals from all the wars we have fought. Follow that up with the Spanish influenza pandemic raging from 1918 to 1920, when 90% of the indigenous population was wiped out, about 8 million souls, and all the firing squad executions and the assassinations, both Zapata and Villa, were betrayed and killed, plus 3 presidents fell to assassins' hands, and it is hard to make sense of it all. But we corralled the best scholars, writers, and researchers of the Mexican Revolution to give you a balanced overview of all the carnage and what it actually means. As Pancho Villa biographer Frederick Katz puts it, as in the history of most revolutions, the bloodiest phase of the Mexican Revolution occurred not when the revolutionaries were fighting the old regime, but when they began to fight each other. So the Mexican Revolution morphed into a civil war from 1915 to 1920. It is not for the squeamish at heart, and the controversy the war engendered is still with us. As one of the alleged masterminds behind the assassination of Pancho Villa put it on his deathbed, "I am not a murderer. I rid humanity of a monster." Wyatt's Stallion, The Apache Kid, and The Code of the West. What became of Wyatt Earp's horse, Dick Naylor? It seems Dick Naylor just disappeared from the pages of history. We know he was Wyatt's favorite racehorse. Billy Clanton stole him soon after the Earps arrived in Tombstone. Wyatt retrieved him several months later in Charleston, and Virgil was riding him the evening Billy Claiborne was being transported to Tombstone after killing a man in Charleston. Wyatt had a lot on his plate in the coming months, and his stallion isn't mentioned. Was he riding him on his vendetta? Is he the horse who tried to unload Wyatt at Cottonwood Springs? He didn't have him when he and Doc left Arizona. Did he give or sell him to one of his friends on his posse? Wyatt did a lot of wheeling and dealing when he was in Tombstone. Apparently, he didn't feel it was worth mentioning. The career of a racehorse is short, so it's likely Wyatt sold him after his racing days were done, or before. Dick Naylor seems to have had no role in the Cochise County War, but then neither did any of the other horses. He could have sold him to a rancher like Henry Clay Hooker to use as stud for his mares in the Crooked H, or, horrors, sold him to some dude who'd geld him for his kids to ride. A terrible end for a stallion named Dick Naylor. When did the first autos appear in the old Wild West towns? Because of the land around Dodge City was more automobile-friendly, there would have been more cars there and earlier than in the rugged hills, canyons, and mountains of Arizona. The first horseless carriage, or gas buggy, didn't arrive in Arizona until 1899, when Dr. Hiram Thinner of Tucson had one shipped in on the Southern Pacific Railroad. It was a locomobile. Dr. Thinner also had the distinction of having the first wreck. His locomobile got away from him and crashed into a saguaro cactus. The first auto to arrive in Phoenix was in 1902. It would also have been shipped by rail. There were no gas stations, so fuel had to be purchased at a drugstore. Repairs were done at the blacksmith's. There is a U.S. Naval National Forest map, the Apache Kid Wilderness, that shows Apache Kid's gravesite. Is that accurate? According to Linda A. Sanchez, in her February 2019 True West article, The Final Nail in the Apache Kid's Coffin, the Apache Kid was killed in a November 1900 fight with Mormon settlers in Chihuahua, Mexico. According to the settlers, they buried the kid and two others in a common grave in the Sierra Madre. But that grave has not been rediscovered since then. Do you know how the term Coat of the West originated? The Coat of the West was born with the Silver Screen Cowboys. It was first chronicled by Zane Grey in his 1934 novel, The Coat of the West. No written code ever existed, but an unwritten, socially agreed-upon set of informal laws shaped the cowboy culture. Did a youngster named Al Smith name Hole in the Wall? It looks that way. I went to some of the experts on it, Dan Buck, Linda Womack, and Donna Ernst. They all suggested I contact Mike Bell in the UK for the final word. He sent info from a clipping from the papers of J. Elmer Brock, published as Powder River Country in Casey, Wyoming in 1981, and edited by his daughter, Margaret Brock Hansen. According to Elmer Brock, several of the neighbors had gathered at the Brocks on mail day. Someone asked young Al Smith where he got his mail. He replied, "Just from a hole in the wall." The name stuck, and it referred to the whole valley behind several miles of red sandstone bluffs called the Wall. This occurred in 1895. Contrary to popular belief, Butch Cassidy never made his headquarters there. He certainly passed through at different times because the local people knew him. At no time was there a big force there, more than a dozen, of organized rustlers in the hole.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading additional articles for the Western Magazine Hour, looking at True West Magazine. Today, we'll be reading from articles that were published in True West back in 2009. First, from the November-December 2009 edition. The Last Link to the Little Bighorn by Mark Boardman. He is the one living connection to the Battle of the Little Bighorn, or Custer's Last Stand, if you prefer. He's an old man now, 96 on October 27th. His hearing is bad, his eyes are weak, and he's been sick a fair amount in the past year. But Joe Medicine Crow's mind is clear and his voice is strong as he tells the stories of that hot and dry day, June 25th, 1876, when a large force of Indians destroyed the U.S. 7th Cavalry in southeastern Montana. Medicine Crow heard the stories from the men who were there, both Custer foes and allies. Voices of the Elders. Medicine Crow's mind retreats to 1920 when he was six or seven and living near Lodge Grass, Montana, about 5 miles from the battlefield. In the fall and spring, the old men gathered in the sweat lodges to purify their bodies and minds, to reminisce about the past, and to mourn for its loss. Usually, they recounted their bravery in battle. As you might expect, the Little Bighorn was a favorite subject. One of those men was his grandmother's stepbrother. Stay with us here. Who, by Crow tradition, is also considered his grandfather. White Man Runs Him, born around 1858, was one of Custer's scouts on the ill-fated mission. He took the boy Joe to the lodges to hear their tales. The elders said the problems began before the fighting started. White Man Runs Him insisted that Custer's soldiers had been drinking that day, Medicine Crow remembers. The men of the 7th weren't ready for a tough fight. Then the scouts went to a high point of rocks to spy on the Indian encampment and realized that they faced several thousand warriors. Just how many is still unclear. Custer didn't really believe them, and he certainly wasn't fazed. His only concern was that the Indian force might escape before he could get to them. Custer did not take the advice of his Crow scouts, who told him to wait for reinforcements before attacking the Sioux and Cheyenne camp, Medicine Crow says. Instead, he divided his force of 700 soldiers into three parts and attacked right away. The scouts knew what awaited. They began changing from army uniforms into their native clothing and singing their death songs. Custer asked an interpreter to explain the Indians' actions. When he was told, Custer accused them of being cowards and sent them away. That saved their lives. The last White Man Runs Him saw of Custer in his detail. They were charging toward the Little Bighorn River, heading for the huge Indian village. Estimates range from several hundred lodges to a couple thousand, and the stuff of legend. At that point, White Man Runs Him said, "We went back along the ridge and found Major Marcus Reno's men entrenched there. We stayed there all afternoon, fighting off the Indians. When darkness fell, the scout made his way through enemy lines and found troops coming to support Custer." It was a story that Joe Medicine Crow would hear many times. They didn't want to hear. Frequently, the young man served as interpreter for his grandfather, especially when white newspapermen and writers came for interviews about the Custer fight. Medicine Crow says that most refused to believe the stories, which flew in the face of the white image of Custer as a brave fighter who was ambushed by savages. Finally, White Man Runs Him had his fill. Facing a skeptical interviewer, he told the boy in Crow, "Send him home. He does not want to know the truth." The mid-60s man rarely spoke of the battle to whites after that. Medicine Crow faced similar disbelief throughout the years, yet he didn't stop telling the Crow stories. Feet in Two Worlds. Medicine Crow's relatives were not afraid to face the truth. The younger people would have to live in the white man's world, so while they brought them up with the old customs, speaking the Crow language and learning the way of the warrior, the elders sent the children to white schools. It was tough, Medicine Crow says. The Indian kids faced physical and emotional bullying from their mainly white peers, and either indifference or discrimination from the teachers. Most dropped out. Medicine Crow stayed, but he didn't get his high school diploma until he was 21 years old. Then he became the second member of the tribe to attend college, and the first to obtain a graduate degree, earning a master's in anthropology from the University of Southern California. He was well on his way to a PhD when World War II interrupted. Combat action in Europe provided an opportunity to bring his two worlds together and to prove his own worth as a warrior. In early 1945, Medicine Crow and the 103rd Army Division were driving through Germany, trying to finish up the war in Europe. He put war paint on his arms and a sacred eagle feather under his helmet, believing the strong medicine would protect him. It apparently did more than that. In an era of advanced warfare, Medicine Crow accomplished four tasks required of a Crow war chief: steal an enemy's horse, touch an enemy in battle, take away an enemy's weapon, and lead a successful war party. Nobody since has achieved that honor. it probably won't be done again. To this day, he proudly tells stories of his accomplishments in battle, just like White Man Runs him and his other ancestors did. A 21st Century Crow. More honors have come Medicine Crow's way over the years, including his receipt of this year's Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. He's written numerous books and articles, and given more interviews than one can count. In the oral tradition of his Crow tribe, he passes the stories on to younger generations, Indian as well as white, who need to understand their history and culture if they are to be successful in the modern world. Joe Medicine Crow has already blazed that path, a nearly 100-year journey filled with great achievements. Again, that article was written in 2009 from True West Magazine. Here's a very small section about Joe Medicine Crow from Wikipedia. Medicine Crow continued to write and lecture at universities and public institutions until his death at age 102 on April 3, 2016. He was in hospice care in Billings, Montana. He is survived by his only son, Ron Medicine Crow, daughters Vernell Medicine Crow and Diane Reynolds, and stepdaughter Garnett Watton. True West Magazine, September 2009. The Vaquero, a World-Class Horseman, by Lee Anderson. As an Old West fan, you may have tried your hand at riding a horse. You might even consider yourself pretty proficient at it. Some of you can only imagine what it must be like to sit astraddle a 5-foot-tall, half a ton of living, thinking, lightning-quick muscle with nothing more than a pair of thin, narrow strips of leather attached to it for control. Whatever your level of experience, imagine what it would be like to have this animal respond to your every whim and, at the lightest feather touch on the reins, regardless of how fast your horse is moving or how dynamic the maneuver is you ask it to perform, this is precisely the everyday working relationship of the Spanish and Mexican vaquero has had with his mount as far back as the 1700s. He was, in every sense of the phrase, a world-class horseman. The horsemanship of the average American cowboy, no offense, pales in comparison. Conquistador training. The roots of the Mexican vaquero's unique horsemanship go back a couple of centuries before the Spanish conquistadors landed in what is now Mexico in the late 1400s. As military men, their horsemanship was the result of several centuries of battlefield-tested horsemanship in Europe. Back then, only the social elite and the military were allowed to even ride a horse. In New Spain, now Mexico, however, 50 years of cattle herds on the open range called for peon herdsmen to ride horses. The only source with this knowledge, the time and the experience to train these men, was the military. The soldiers were teaching these first vaqueros the fine art of equitation and dressage 500 years ago. For the next 300 years, the vaqueros adapted and perfected their dressage-based horsemanship skills to the working of huge herds of cattle. By 1800, they had elevated their horsemanship to such a science, it was truly an art form beautiful to behold. To some degree, circumstances forced this artistry on them. Spanish horses were not large, around 800 pounds, and a full-grown Spanish bull could easily tip 1,100 or 1,200. Handling one of these bulls after it was lassoed required perfect teamwork between horse and rider. The horse responded to nothing more than a shift of the vaquero's weight and leg pressure. In comparison, American cowboys preferred light horse breeds, weighing 800 to 1,300 pounds, using the lighter horses for pulling buggies and for pleasure riding. Unlike the vaqueros, most American cowboys did not train their horses to respond to the rider's body language. Texas cowboys developed their own style of riding that spread throughout the American West, in which they used split reins and moved their hands to the left or right of the saddle to control the horse by neck reining. The neck rein is the cornerstone to the partnership of the cowboy and his mount in America. The Vaquero was not without his need for proper equipment. His long, braided, rawhide riata rope was 60 to 100 feet long, while his saddle had a large diameter saddle horn. If he roped the horns of a bull, his riata was then wrapped around the saddle horn a couple of times, and being braided, stretched enough so as not to break. The vaquero then used the large saddle horn as a friction brake to play the bull to a stop. The horse turned its butt under the rope and leaned into the pull. If the bull was too aggressive after it was roped, the horse could be quickly sent scampering all the way around it, so the rope completely encircled all four legs, and the animal went down as it was pulled tight. Roping and jerking the front legs out from under it was the safest and easiest way to put a heavy or a mean animal down. The vaquero could also throw the bull to the ground at a dead run without even lassoing it. He would reach down, grab its tail, swing his leg and stirrup leather over it, then turn his horse away at a right angle. At that speed, the bull would stumble and go down temporarily stunned. Horses trained to this high level invariably carried the famous spade bit and were the only horses allowed to wear the alamar at a fiesta or other public function. This distinctive knot hung around the neck at the center of the horse's chests. At a fiesta, vaqueros often fastened each rein to a bit with a single hair from the horse's tails to then see who could perform the most impressive maneuvers without the hair breaking. The 19th century vaquero. By the 1800s, the vaquero was a virtual fashion plate and a sight to behold even while working. He was so skilled at his job that he wore what would be equivalent to a modern business suit while working and roping cattle. The vaquero was flashy, preferring bright colors, silver-mounted bits and spurs, and silver conchos down the length of the outer seams of his pants. If he wore knee-length pants, he'd wear decorative leather botas, boots, strapped around his lower leg. He topped off his attire with a wide-brimmed sombrero and a Mexican short jacket because it didn't interfere with his riding or roping. Modern Levi jackets are modeled after it. He affixed his riata, when not in use, to the side of his saddle behind the cantle with the ever-present serap draped over the back of the horse, tied behind the cantle, and looped through the coils of the riata. This effectively prevented the rope from flopping around when the horse was galloping. The Spanish did not neuter animals, allowing for nearly a 100% calf and colt crop every year and explaining the phenomenal growth of their herds. Several early California ranches inventoried, oh yes, they had taxes, cattle herds of anywhere from 100,000 to more than 500,000. One rancho reported 500 well-reined horses. Since vaqueros did not begin training a horse until its fourth year, the entire herd had to be 10 times that many. In this male-dominant culture, it was beneath the dignity of a vaquero to ride any horse other than a stallion. At a rodear, roundup, one man took charge of the horses. He would stretch a rope between two stakes for the morning formado formation. When the stallions were brought in from night grazing, he would verbally command them, and they would, with impeccable manners, line up in a specific order, with their back legs against the stretched rope. Each vaquero would select his caballo del día, horse of the day, lead it to his equipment, and saddle up. The horses not chosen were then verbally turned loose for the day. To this day, the old-time vaqueros' everyday horse training skills have never been surpassed for their efficiency, nor their sheer artistry and beauty. Finding vaqueros today. Before the mid-1800s, media coverage and photography west of the Mississippi River was in its infancy. Therefore, we possess extremely little documentation of the Spanish culture that dominated the Western scene for some 300 years previous. When writers and photographers were drawn into the westward expansion frenzy, their documents of the American West portrayed the Mexican as insignificant. How could they have realized the Mexican impact on the West when many of them could not communicate in Spanish with the vaqueros? Movies would enhance the cowboy myth of the insignificant vaquero even further, farther, and faster. For all of these reasons, misconceptions still abound about the vaquero. In 1998, Robert Redford starred in The Horse Whisperer. His character, Tom Broker, is hired by Annie to heal their daughter's horse. When they meet, she tells him, "I've heard you help people with horse problems." Broker replies, "Truth is, I help horses with people problems." The natural horsemanship portrayed in this film may be partly responsible for the resurgence of vaquero horsemanship in America. Many traditionalists were able to revive it thanks to studious historians such as Ed Connell, who published numerous books discussing Spanish-style equitation. You'll find vaqueros in historical fiction, such as Tom Lee's 1964 novel, The Hands of Cantu, which shares the story of the gifted hands of the best horsemen ever seen in New Spain. Recent documentary films have also brought the artistry of the vaqueros to light. Corazon Vaquero, The Heart of the Cowboy, Lindeza Films, visits families of Baja California who have lived for more than 300 years on ranches without roads. J&S Productions shares the history in a 5-series set, with the last of the five, The First Vaqueros, tracing the roots to Mexico and California. Museums are also paying attention, with the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum in Oklahoma City exhibiting 120 examples of craftsmanship and design distinctive to the vaquero in Arte en la Charrería from October 10, 2009 through January 3, 2010. Those who want to practice this dying art can seek training from the author in Glendale, Arizona, Ernie Morris in Templeton, California, Richard Caldwell in Alturas, California, and Jeff Sanders in Fallon, Nevada. Some organizations preserve the heritage of California vaqueros, who combined the Spanish style of riding with California's ranching lifestyle. The Californio Ranch Horse Association and the Californios are the best known, with the former hosting a fiesta competition at different locations every summer, and the latter hosting a ranch roping contest in Red Bluff, California, every April. For more than 500 years, the vaquero has ruled cattle ranches, paving the way for our American cowboys. Will the art of the vaquero vanish for good in America? Not if we can help it. Lee Anderson knows about real cowboys. This retired aerospace engineer living in Glendale, Arizona, has spent more than 60 years studying the Spanish colonial vaqueros of 1750 to 800, the Mexican cowboys of 1850 to 1900, and the American cowboys of 1880 to 1920. The horse training tools, methods, and traditions he gleaned from the vaqueros have informed his own teaching, which he shares in his book, Developing the Art of Equine Communication, published by Moonlight Mesa Associates. Anderson offers up his living history tutelage in period performances with his horse and faithful partner Concho as an amazing Arizonan for the Arizona Historical Society. Vaquero in a Vacuum, September 2009, True West, by Jay Dussard. I've heard it said countless times that if you can punch cows in Yavape County, Arizona, you can punch cows anywhere. The rough, steep, brushy, boulder-strewn terrain provided the tests that young Monk Maxwell passed with soaring colors. He apprenticed with his father, Virgil, who tied his catch rope hard and fast, Texas style, and made super-handling horses at the Circle Bar Ranch. Then way back a beyond on the Yolo Ranch, run by a cowman deluxe, his uncle Gene Smith, Monk reveled in the demands of the country and cattle, made a top hand, and rose to the rank of jigger boss, second in command to the ranch foreman. When I learned of Monk in the late 1960s, His young family had brought him a bit closer to civilization, to the Wineglass Ranch in the Chino Valley, Big Chino area. I first photographed him at the Del Rio division of the Wineglass. When Monk trotted toward me on his fine buckskin mount, what caught my attention was the swaying motion of the long eagle-bill tapaderos, fancy leather stirrup covers, my first live sighting of such elegant appurtenances. This gentleman of the range was not at all what I was accustomed to seeing in my rather limited experience in the cow countries of Texas and Arizona. Flat-brimmed hat, slick fork saddle with no flank cinch, fancy silver bit, braided rawhide reins with silver chains. Clearly, my education was far from complete. Naturally, I asked Monk about his horse gear. "It's California style, and it goes all the way back to the old-time vaqueros," he told me. "Dunny's packing a spade bit, a bit that contacts the roof of the horse's mouth versus the curved mouthpiece of a curved bit. It took me quite a while to get him through the stages to where he now handles like a dream. The saddle's a three-quarter single rig, Weatherly a fork. I use a long rope and take my dallies." He went on to explain that vaqueros have long been known for their skill and patience in training ultra-responsive, trigger-reined horses. This result was achieved in three progressive steps over a lengthy period of time. The horse was started in a hackamore with a simple noseband, the bozal, with reins. Next came a lighter bozalillo, plus a bit in the mouth, with reins on both, called the two-rein. Last came only the bit, and the horse was declared straight up in the bridle. Quite a few years would pass before I rode and worked cattle in fairly easy country with Monk, but my first good impression of him was with me to stay. One day at Prescott College, where I taught photography, the advance man for a movie company just happened to run into me. "Did I know anything about locations, livestock, etc.?" "Yes, but you really ought to hire Monk Maxwell. He knows the country and can fix you up with anything you need." They did, and Monk delivered as advertised, even becoming one of the on-screen baddies in the 1971 low-budget cult film Billy Jack. He was up, down, all over the place, absolutely fearless, just like a little monkey. That's what Dorothy Maxwell told me about her son, Virgil Jr., when I asked her the origin of the name Monk. That brand of nerve and athleticism was to serve him well throughout his freelance career of catching and bringing in cattle that had gone to the wild in ranching's nether reaches. Over the years, Monk ran a couple of ranches and even worked at a much-despised stretch as a transcontinental trucker. But mostly, he prowled remote mountains and canyons, usually on contract with ranchers who had wily cattle back in the rough stuff that had eluded normal roundups. Since I never had the opportunity, nor the mettle, to accompany Monk on one of his wild cow forays, I simply asked questions and took note of his descriptions and lore. A gig might go like this. Trail up some errant bovine, say a maverick bull with several years' growth and horns to match. Get him roped and maneuvered up close to a tree and sufficiently fouled to be able to safely, a relative term at best, dismount and anchor him to the tree. Tie El Toro, the bull, so he will neither choke nor escape. Then saw enough of his horns to render them blunt. Ride away, perhaps to find more critters, but in any case, to leave the captive to make either war or peace with El Arbol, the tree. Return later and lead the chastened bull and possibly other cloven-hooved companions downrange to a corral or stock trailer. Some years ago, Monk was leading a renegade bull down a rough, snow-covered mountain. The bull rammed Monk, breaking the cowboy's ankle and nearly sending his horse off a bluff. He led the bull 9 miles down to a corral, then rode another 11 back up to the mountain to his camp to get his pickup and drive into town to a doctor. A week later, he was back on the mountain, horseback, with his leg in a cast, chasing wild cattle. If you're going to make a living gathering wild cattle, you have to know how to get all this done working alone, Monk explains. When I'm roping, I like for my run to be uphill. Once I have something caught, I get on the uphill side. So if we get charged, my horse and I have gravity on our side. If you're riding up to something wild in the brush, never approach from the downhill side, because if he charges, you don't want him to have a momentum advantage. If you have to turn away and your horse hangs up in the brush, you've had it. If you end up on the bottom of the wreck, you can get killed. I've been able to get my job done because of the careful schooling I've given the horses and mules that I've used in this line of work. My mounts really have to handle with precision. Position is the key to keeping the advantage. I've always roped with the loose twine and taken my dallies. In all these years, I've only had one horse badly injured, a busted leg. I never did work for any of those huge buckaroo outfits that run a wagon and have a big crew, but I've always stayed with the old vaquero ways over here in my home country. Monk and his wife, Wanda, now live on and run a remote high-elevation ranch that straddles the Arizona-New Mexico border. In late 2007, the rather routine act of roping a gentle range cow in a corral on a seasoned horse turned into a colossal wreck. Hours of evacuation, pickup to ambulance to helicopter, were excruciating. At the hospital in Las Cruces, New Mexico, doctors determined that Monk had suffered a massive heart attack and he came close to losing a badly damaged leg. As of this writing, the man is back at it, rawhide reins and long catch rope in hand, forking an ancient Visalia centerfire saddle that would receive an approving nod from just about any vaquero viejo. Learning the ropes. In roping, one can tie the rope to the saddle horn, then go and catch something. As long as the rope or the horn doesn't break, the something stays caught. If the something is big and soggy, one can expect a major impact to both horse and critter when the rope comes taut. Alternatively, one can catch something with a loose rope, then dally-welty some rope around the saddle horn to complete the catch. The author references this in his article as My Dallies. Dally-welty is the rough anglicization of the Spanish dar la vuelta, which means to give the turn. If the horn has been wrapped with inner tube rubber, a turn or two will hold the critter. If the horn is slick, wrapped with leather vaquero style, the number of turns is adjusted to the situation, with the advantage that the rope can be run to gradually set the brake, thus minimizing the impact of stopping a heavy critter. Old-time vaqueros used only hand-braided or twisted rawhide riatas with which to catch and handle stock. These gut lines were not nearly as strong as modern nylon or poly ropes, so they had to be handled with considerable finesse to prevent breakage. True West, September 2009. The Misery of Mining in the Old West by Dr. Jim Kornberg. For many miners, the report of 34-year-old Dr. Anthony J. Lanza came a day late and a dollar short. Near the beginning of the last century, this controversial physician tried to unravel the mystery of why tuberculosis, TB, was killing Butte, Montana underground miners at a rate 10 times the national average. Hired by the Montana Tuberculosis Association between 1916 and 1918, Dr. Lanza examined more than 1,000 miners and found among the several hundred with lung disease, more than five dozen who had tuberculosis. His work eventually connected the risks of TB to those miners who had developed silicosis, a dust-related disease caused by exposure to free silica in the mining atmosphere. Today's physicians have come to understand that the presence of silicosis may compromise a patient's immune system. Silica exposure may make a healthy patient more likely to contract TB or may compromise the ability of a TB patient to control its spread. Along with keeping exposure to a minimum, minors exposed to silica are now carefully evaluated on a periodic basis with thorough interviews, physical examinations, x-rays, and laboratory tests. As a result, the scourge of TB is practically non-existent in today's hard rock mining population. Regardless of the risks, mining in the Old West was as common as fleas on a dog. For many, the lure and risks of mining represented the American dream. Mining was the ultimate form of gambling. Most miners came away from the table with little or nothing. But some who staked their own claims in gold strikes at Sutter's Mill, Cripple Creek, and Alder Gulch came away as big winners. The flip side of these stories, however, is one of sudden or premature death, crippling injury, and wasting, disabling disease. While underground, miners faced risks of fires and carbon monoxide, poor lighting, little ventilation, and even altitude sickness. In addition, there were no consistent engineering practices to avoid cave-ins. Most mines offered no sanitation or clean water. If a worker had to go while underground, he often went right where he was working. Personal protective equipment was hardly ever provided by mine owners. If you did not lose a finger, an eye, or a foot, then you faced the wear and tear of arthritis, the destruction of your lungs, the risk of infection, or the poisoning of your nervous system from arsenic and mercury contamination in the gold ore that you were so optimistically seeking. Essentially, no statistics about miners' accidents, illnesses, or deaths were maintained in the Old West. Much of what we know about them today comes from headlines about mine disasters. Consider the Central City, Colorado Evening Call recounting the death of Charles Rolfe in a cave-in at the Malachi Mine near Golden on March 19, 1878. Or the Cheyenne Weekly Leader's report of the loss of 38 miners in the Central Pacific Mine explosion near Evanston, Wyoming, on March 10, 1881. Unfortunately, headlines like these have not entirely disappeared today. Recall the 6 miners and 3 rescue workers who perished underground at the Crandall Canyon Mine in Huntington, Utah, in August 2007. Yet progress and research have been made in mine safety and health, as well as treating TB, asbestos, and other mine-caused ailments. As a regrettable and interesting footnote to this effort, the good Dr. Lanza reappeared in the 1930s with questionable research for which he was accused of delaying the reporting of asbestos hazards. Today, we continue to make important, sometimes distressing discoveries, whether about radon exposure in uranium mines and the risk of lung cancer or nerve damage from vibrating tools. The list of preventable hazards continues to grow. Our investigations are dedicated to making underground mining healthier and safer for the brave men and women who carry on this important activity. Clinically, I think that Old West miners had to be both delusional and a bit self-destructive. Personally, I would have opened a hardware store and sold those gamblers all the picks and shovels they could carry, of course, with a dust mask or two. Dr. Jim Kornberg holds an MD and an SCD. He is an environmental medicine physician and an engineer. He lives with his wife, Sally, on a ranch in the mountains of southwestern Colorado. True West, September 2009. It's Miller Time Again, by G. Daniel DeWeese. In 1918, Philip Miller got off the train at Denver's Union Station with a sample case of Miller Brothers cowboy hats, most of his worldly possessions, and a persistent cough. When he arrived, the American West was still largely wild and sparsely populated, but the former gold mining camp was already a teeming metropolis with nearly 250,000 people. Denver buried the Old West, along with Buffalo Bill, on nearby Lookout Mountain the year before, and commerce was the new frontier. Little did this sickly hat drummer know he would help define the new West and launch an industry. Miller, in his late 20s, had been dispatched to Denver from New York City by his hat-making brothers. His job was to open new sales territories for the family business. Denver was chosen as his base, not so much for its bustling economy, but for its dry mountain air. They hoped it would help ease his fight with tuberculosis. A family member would later say that he went to Denver to die, but didn't get around to it until he was in his 80s. Miller thrived in his new location, and he launched his own business, Miller Hat Company. Traveling extensively throughout the Rocky Mountain and Great Plains states, he called on small-town mercantiles and remote ranches to sell cowboy hats. The farmers and cowboys he dealt with were having trouble getting boots, clothes, saddles, and other necessities for life in the West. Seeing an opportunity, Miller started the Stockman Farmer Supply Company and published his first catalog in 1923. He soon amended his company's name to Miller Stockman Supply Company and expanded the scope of his business. By the mid-1930s, he was manufacturing clothes for ranchers and cowboys as Miller Western Wear. Fast forward to the 1980s, Philip Miller had retired in 1962, and the company he founded was a full-blown conglomerate called Miller International Incorporated. The company included the original Miller Stockman catalog division, 30 Miller Stockman retail stores, Miller Western Wear shirt manufacturing, and Rocky Mountain brand jeans for women. The Rockies were not the standard Western five-pocket boot-cut denim jeans. They offered a flattering fit and unique styling that quickly became the company's best-selling product. In 1992, Miller Western Wear was renamed the Rocky Mountain Clothing Company, and the last shirt with Miller's name on the label was produced. Rocky Mountain Clothing Company introduced mainstream cinch jeans and shirts for men in 1996. Aside from the evocative name and its availability from Western stores and catalogs, there was nothing intrinsically Western about the line. 2 years later, Cruel Girl debuted as a female version of cinch. In 1999, 76 years after Philip Miller published his first catalog, Miller International sold off the catalog and the retail stores as the company focused on its manufacturing and design business. Despite the fact that the last Miller Stockman catalog was mailed to more than 3 million customers, Philip Miller's name all but disappeared from the Western market. Rocky Mountain Clothing Company returned to its Western roots with the launch of Southern Thread in 2004. The shirts and jeans were designed and marketed to appeal to young male fans of Red Dirt music, the alternative country music inflected with Woody Guthrie's folk sensibilities and Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson's outlaw attitudes. This year, Rocky Mountain Clothing Company has revived the Miller name with a collection of classically styled, high-end men's Western shirts and outerwear called Miller Ranch. The line and the brand were conceived as an upscale tribute to both the Miller legacy and life on the ranch. The genesis of this line started 2 years ago when Rocky Mountain executives began collecting Miller Stockman catalogs and Miller Western shirts. Their original intention was to augment the company's archives, which were found to be wanting whenever some company history needed to be researched. "Some of us started collecting stuff so we could have a little history room here," recalls Keith Mundy, vice president for marketing and sales. As they collected old Miller memorabilia, they began thinking about the legacy of the company and its role in fostering the Western lifestyle. They looked at the Western shirt category and noticed a gap in the upper end for high-quality shirts with traditional Western styling. One problem they faced immediately was the name. The rights to Miller Stockman and Miller Western Wear were sold along with the stores and catalogs in 1999. They came up with Miller Ranch and decided to produce a limited, high-quality collection, Mundy says. "We felt this was a segment of the market that was underserved, and that's typically what we do here. We look for gaps and try to fill those gaps. With Miller Ranch, we wanted to carry on the legacy of the Miller name." Veteran Western apparel designer Mary Epelitos was the lead designer of the Miller Ranch collection. A lot of her inspiration and a lot of her direction came from our CEO, David Dean, along with Bobby Smith, vice president of Western Brands, Mundy says. What we wanted to do was build a very fine men's shirt, done tastefully, something that we thought wasn't already out there. It's about the history of the West without being howdy-doody. The new collection may revive the venerable Miller name, but it is not based on any past Miller Westernwear product. Miller was more of a price-driven commodity type of product, Smith explains. Miller Ranch is a premium brand that is being targeted to a premium customer. That premium customer includes anyone who appreciates and is willing to pay for well-made clothing. He is a man whose tastes run to timeless styling with luxurious touches. He may or may not ride horses or own cattle, but he aspires to the Western lifestyle. He may even normally wear conventional dress shirts for work, but dresses Western after hours and on weekends because he likes the fit and look. Miller Ranch gives him the option of wearing finely woven Western shirts that are appropriate in the boardroom, a favorite restaurant, or out at the ranch. The debut line has a dozen shirts with top quality fabrics and impeccable tailoring. Selections include a beefy cotton white Oxford, a richly colored fine whale corduroy shirt, tropical weight fine wool styles, premium cotton dress shirts, and softly brushed fine line twills in four different plaid patterns. The shirts feature deft touches like premium grade neck tape, double needle stitching, and hidden button-down collars. Traditional Western styling treatments include classic single peak front and back yokes, scalloped or saw-tooth flap pockets, and double adjustable snap cuffs, also Miller Ranch branded snap or button closures. The 2009 fall line also includes a plaid 18-ounce wool vest and a handsome wool coat loaded with convenient pockets, snap closure side vents, and the technical wherewithal to withstand a cold norther in the saddle. An interesting aspect of the Miller Ranch collection is that its logo uses the letters M and R in a way that suggests a cattleman's brand, but also mountains and a river. The logo is used extensively on the packaging and on the shirt. All the snaps and buttons are laser engraved with the Miller Ranch logo, Mundy notes. The Miller Ranch logo is done subtly on each shirt in tonal embroidery. The Miller Ranch collection starts at $75 suggested retail and is available at RockyMountainClothing.com and at high-end stores. Philip Miller would be proud to see his name is again being stitched onto shirts in the 21st century. G. Daniel DeWeese co-authored the book Western Shirts, A Classic American Fashion, Gibbs Smith, 2004. Ranch-raised near the Black Hills in South Dakota, Dan has written about Western apparel and riding equipment for more than 25 years.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the coronavirus update at 1.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Tuesday, January 26, 2021. Vaccine distribution. Russell Myers, President and CEO for MMH, answers questions after a media tour Saturday of the COVID-19 vaccination site at the Midland County Horseshoe. Vaccine information. The Midland Unified Command Team will begin administering COVID-19 vaccine to Phase 1A and 1B individuals this week at the Midland County Horseshoe Backstage Facility by appointment only. If you are in Phases 1A, healthcare workers, or 1B, over 65 and/or diagnosed with a chronic disease, and have not had COVID-19 in the past 90 days. You can register to get on the list for this distribution and future allocations of the COVID-19 vaccine by visiting MidlandHealth.org/vaccine and clicking on the Click to Register button. Detailed information defining the populations included in these phases is available on the above-mentioned website. A phone line is being set up for those without internet access and released at a later date. Once on the waiting list, you will not receive a phone call to be scheduled. You will be assigned an appointment time and date and receive an email or text message with the information needed. For further questions, visit MidlandHealth.org/vaccine.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 48 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. Then tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.